And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
I am Phil Lernis here in Los Angeles and across the country in Motown.
Halfway.
It's the, not halfway, you're in the Eastern time zone, for crying out loud. It's the Motor City Madman. It's Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
I'm good. How are you is more the question. What the update is on the old eyeballs?
On the old eyeballs. Well, we did the pre-op tests for people who don't know, going in for surgery on the eyes, on the peepers, starting July 2nd. We went through all the pre-op exams, got the EKG and the blood work and the chest x-ray, and my cat was allowed to stay at home, but it was a nightmare. It was an utter nightmare because I'm in pretty massive amounts of head pain due to the eye strain every day, and it just seems to be getting worse. But as you know, it's not really the pain that I mind so much as the constant craving for human blood. But but anyway, you know, and I'm there and I'm vulnerable. I can't see. I'm doing these tests. People are poking and prodding me and sending me to other departments where they can poke and prod me. And, you know, well, there's a little bit, it looks like an irregularity on your EKG. I mean, this might be your normal baseline. We don't know, but we'd like you to go see the cardiologist so he can run you around on a treadmill. And I'm going, I'm not doing this until after I can see. Oh, yeah, okay, well, I guess you're right. Yeah, all right, well, that's fine. And then, we'd like you to get a colonoscopy. Wait a minute, what the hell does that have to do with the chest x-ray? What are you... Well, it's just time. That's what you love, is to hear, just time.
You should have done that, you should have done that years ago.
Well, did do it years ago. I mean, I had what they said, have you ever had one? And I said, yeah, about like 19 years ago. And then people I've never met coming in throughout the session to ask, hey, out of curiosity, why'd you have a colonoscopy when you were so young?
Hilarious.
So,
you said,
did I ever tell you about when I was a kid? This still busts me up to this day. There was a pamphlet at our local library, the Cupertino Public Library, don't you know? And it had a clown, one of the crying kind of clowns, right?
Yes.
You know, with the painted on tears.
And right, he was on like Red Skelton used to paint.
He was on the exactly. And he was on the cover of this pamphlet. And the pamphlet said, there's nothing funny about colon cancer. That was the pamphlet at the... So there's nothing funny about colon cancer except that pamphlet, really. Because that would just make me just die with hysterics. That somebody thought, oh, this is how we reach the people with the information.
Right. The sad clown.
Yeah.
Because that's... No one wants to know a clown has any sort of colon rectal problems. I don't want to know that.
So I'd be shocked if a clown didn't. All right. I should have said that. Have you had a colonoscopy lately? Well, my new wife did make me attend the circus.
Wow. Wow. That would have been more questions right there.
So anyway, so July 2nd, we get the first eyeball done. And the good news is that after all the pre-ops, went back in for more measuring tests, and I've grown an inch. No, measuring tests of the lens, because I thought it was due to the rarity of this particular cataract, i.e. where it's located, that was rendering all their modern technological means of measuring the lenses absolutely irrelevant. That it was like these cataracts have stealth technology. And so every signal, everything was bouncing back at them, and they couldn't get a measurement on the lens. And I thought it was because of the rarity vis-a-vis exactly where it's located. But it turns out that, yes, the rarity proved that it would be difficult to locate the cataract. But in terms of the difficulty in measuring the lens for a replacement, it's because of how dense my cataracts are.
Wow.
Yes. And when they said that, when they talked about how dense they are, as you know, as you would expect, I said, dense, I'd love to. All
right, so, but I'm hearing music and no one's there.
There
you go. So
from my eyes to Lilu's teeth, you've got a teething Doberman puppy on your hands, Doberman. At your neck, I think.
Right. So if you hear jumping, barking, and or shouting back and forth during this podcast, you know that it is basically the hourly occurrence of the self-awareness that your teeth are coming through your skull.
Yeah.
Doberman style.
But what will Lilu be doing while we hear that?
She will be putting her teeth through my skull, actually. That'll be the end of that. No, the of course, if you don't know, the puppy teeth of the Doberman are razor sharp, razor like, and so now the adult teeth come in. They're thankfully just a little duller, believe it or not. So we won't have as much blood all over the house as we've had in the last 4 months.
Just like this podcast through the years, just gotten a little duller.
But same amount of blood everywhere.
Same amount of blood. Same friendship, same amount of blood. This is possibly the right time to bring up a little bit of a production meeting then.
Oh, let's do it.
Because I had an idea. I've been slowly, largely because it is difficult with how little I'm seeing, but I've been slowly building back the archive of shows to our new website. And so within the next week or so, we'll have a good year's worth of shows up there, all of this past year.
Okay.
But I was thinking that one of the ways I could speed this along is if every week when we are posting the new show, if I also post at the same time an archive show, and then that, an idea struck. What if I go back to the beginning? So I continue whenever the mood strikes me to add 5 shows, and work backwards through the years as I've been doing. But what if on the mornings when I'm posting a new show, I also go back to the beginning and post a show? So if I started with this next week, it would mean that I would post the new show and I would post episode 1 again, make that available again. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to do that, it might actually be kind of fun to listen to that show, pull out a little bit of a clip.
Oh, yeah.
Send it to you during the week, and then we would discuss on the new show what we were talking about 12 years ago that week.
And to see how culture shifted.
Yes.
How we have
ruined the internet. Or whether it shifted at all.
Well, that's another good point. Are we still talking comic book movies and our inability to fathom why There's so many comic book movies.
Yeah, what resonates with us?
Yeah.
What do we not remember at all? Like, what seems like I don't have any recollection of why we were talking about that, why we would talk about that, or what really resonates even more now, what resonates more culturally, you know, what is still relevant. And I thought it'd be fun, just each week, spend a few minutes talking about what we were talking about 12 years ago that very week.
Yeah, I'm in. All right. I like everything about this idea.
Good. Fantastic.
So start that up.
Well, that brings you to an end of another Oh, no, we still have...
That was easy.
Hey, it's been a while, but I've got a live event of the week.
Well, no, this is something.
Do you too or not?
No, I don't. Well, I'm just surprised you went out. That's all.
Well, you know why? It's because I now tend to produce a lot of live events of the week.
Really? Okay.
The Chilpac Hollywood live event of the week.
So last night at Friendship Auditorium, we had another in our ongoing Encore Sundays presentations of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club. And last night, it was a classical piano recital by young Mr. Nicholas Galanitis. Who played an array of classical tunes as well as an original composition that I got to tell you brought the house down. Not only was the original composition a crowd pleaser, but I started finally seeing very clearly this screenplay that I've wanted to write for a couple of years now. So it was very inspiring. But this young man, a native Marylander, who's already at a very young age, the musical director at a handful of churches in Pennsylvania, was out here just vacationing and fell in with the Breakfast Club and had played for us at the end of our programs in the morning, and we wanted to bring him to a nighttime audience. So what better way to spend a little bit of a Sunday evening than with a classical music recital?
Ooh, that sounds good.
To tame the savage breast, is that as the saying goes?
Savage, I don't know. Beast?
Savage beast? I don't know. Breast beast? What's an R?
Whatever
between
savage.
Yeah. What's an R rating between friends? So it was fantastic, and that's it. That's the full report I've got. We always have something going on.
I want to know, how many people attend these Sunday night shows?
Anywhere from, I would say, 50 to 150. So, a bit more, on average, a bit more than our Breakfast Clubs themselves. We average now in a morning anywhere between 50 and 80. A couple times we've tipped 100 in the morning. But we've pushed past 150 for the Sunday night shows, which you would expect because a lot of people do their complaint about the Wednesday 7 a.m. Breakfast Club is that it's 7 a.m. And we used to think that was a real obstacle towards reviving the club. And now, of course, we appreciate that it's a benefit.
It's a benefit. Because your strength is your weakness, or your weakness is your strength.
Because it pre-qualifies people, first of all, right? If you're the sort of person that can make it at 7 in the morning, you're the sort of person that actually probably will show up for people. And then the other thing about it is there's not a lot of competition. There aren't a lot of other 7 a.m. social organizations in this city to compete with the Breakfast Club for attendance.
That's very true. Isn't that true?
So timing, location. So it's doing very well in terms of membership and doing very well in terms of attendance at the Sunday night shows, and just another way to help restore the club, both by spreading the word and by becoming even more part of the local community, but also by raising more money for this nonprofit organization that had fell into no small measure of economic disrepair because of the people who were robbing it blind when they thought that the club wouldn't last long enough for anyone to check out the books.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
Wow.
When Lily discovered the club, people had been robbing it blind, playing like the band on the deck of the Titanic.
Holy shit. You're kidding.
No.
Ooh, that's not good. Did they make recompense or is it?
No. What do you do? What do you do? You spend a lot of money going after the money that they spent. Fortunately, they couldn't get at the money that endowed the foundation, the charitable foundation. And so the foundation was able to underwrite the club and keep it afloat for quite a while.
Right.
But Lily was able to, you know, turn the ship of state around, another Titanic reference, I guess. And so economically, we're on much more sure footing. And these Encore Sunday shows, as well as other special events, like we had member lunches at the Magic Castle. Paying for the ticket, paying for the usual, lunch prices and everything, the money went towards the club. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Look at that.
See?
That's thinking.
So we.
That's the kind of money raising ideas that make you money.
Said Dean Haglund. That's going to be on your epitaph. At the end of this show. Okay.
So I talked
about that live event. Any more details forthcoming, Dean, about your live appearances?
Yes. Well, according to the organizer, he thought I was coming last Wednesday. So, in fact, it is the 17th of July at the Sellermans. Sellermans is the name of the club, just called Sellermans. In Detroit, just off of Nine Mile Road, which is exactly 9 miles from the Detroit River. Every mile, there's a road, and it tells you how far you are from the river. Isn't that handy?
Yeah. Is that as made famous by Eminem?
At 8 Mile Road, yes. 8 Mile Road. Also, interestingly enough, the streetlights every quarter mile. Every quarter mile, there's a streetlight, which is why now in drag racing, the NHRA has their drag race to be a quarter mile long, is because when the engineers were making their hopped up cars here in Detroit and testing them for competition, they would go on 8 Mile Road. And when the light went green, they'd floor it till the next light. So you have now officially used Detroit's infrastructure to manifest itself into ruledoms of the National Hot Rod Association.
Well, that actually is very interesting.
Isn't that something? Yeah, I talk to even Uber drivers that have lived there their whole life. They go, I didn't know that.
Although, like, yeah. I just naturally assumed that, of course, one circle around a track was always a quarter mile. So I always thought that that was why.
Well, no, every track is... could be built longer or shorter.
But I mean, that's the traditional distance for any racetrack, because before we had car tracks, we still had racetracks.
You know? Yeah, but you didn't drive a car on a pedestrian racetrack. You drove it on
the road. Hey, speak for yourself. I don't know where you grew up. But that's the other thing that I was going to say that actually I thought, oh, well, that's really cool that if you do jog, how awesome to know that, because it's just, okay, I'm going to go for a mile. Today's a mile. Right. So I'm going to go down 2 streetlights and back.
Yeah. Right. So you don't have to measure at all. Lilu, stop chewing my shoes.
Lilu, stop chewing my shoes is so our slogan for, like, if we had a production company at the end of this, you know, like Ubu production, sit Ubu, sit. Lilu, stop chewing my shoes. All right. So July 17th, you are doing a live show. And just really briefly, you talked about this last week, but why don't you tell everybody again what it is that you're doing? Because this is a must-see.
Yes, it's called The Truth Show. And it's similar to Set List, if you've ever seen Set List, where stand-up comics don't know what their set is, and it's projected on a screen, and then they use that as the jumping off point for immediate improvised hilarity. Well, this one's The Truth Show. Instead of stand-up, it's conspiracies. So you are playing a character. In my case, I'm going to be a 90s retro DJ who quit his job because of the Illuminati. And I will endeavor to piece all the conspiracies together in one giant mega conspiracy.
If I still have the letter that I received from the Illuminati, I will invite them to your show.
Please do.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
That might need to be one of the clips that we would play from an old show.
Yeah.
And talk about today, right? When I read that letter on the... Okay, hey, Dean, let's celebrate the moments of their lives. Let's open up the Chill Pack Morgue for what we call celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
We have too many deaths to get to today. I have picked out three just rather randomly, but we'll start with a wonderful character actress because we love the character actors. And this is a case which is more... rare than you would think, but a case where an actual character in real life, an indelible character in real life, lent itself towards becoming a character performer. Because as acclaimed as she was, a character actress, she seemed to be more of a fixture in public consciousness because of the character she was in real life. And that's Sylvia Miles, two-time Academy Award nominated actress, known for her small but indelible roles in such movies as 1969's Midnight Cowboy.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And 1975's Farewell, My Lovely. Those were the two films for which she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress Oscars. In Midnight Cowboy, you might remember she plays a middle-aged woman who has an encounter with the aspiring hustler played by John Voight.
Oh, right.
But what kind of character was Sylvia Miles? Well, enough of a character that she was tapped by Andy Warhol to star in his movie Heat. She played offbeat characters in Crossing Delancey, in Sex in the City. She played Dolores the Realtor in both Wall Street and the 2010 sequel Money Never Sleeps.
Wow.
She was very much a fixture off screen in the New York City social circles and nightlife. And was a favorite throughout the years of the paparazzi. One of my favorites that she was in, both because of her kind of quirky performance and just kind of the quirky nature of the movie itself. It's always had a soft spot for me. It's Evil Under the Sun, one of the Peter Ustinov Hercule Poirot films.
Oh, wow. And I haven't seen that one.
Sylvia Miles. I think that was the second one he did after Death on the Nile.
Yeah.
81, if I'm not mistaken. Also starred Maggie Smith and Diana Rigg. It's good, good stuff, man. Good, good stuff. She's Sylvia Miles, dead at the age of 94.
Wow. That's a good one.
Also, we're remembering this week and celebrating the fascinating life of the poor little rich girl, Gloria Vanderbilt.
Oh, right. Yes. And the heartfelt tribute that her son, Anderson Cooper, gave that I didn't see that everybody's talking about.
Now, isn't that interesting that she lived long enough where the most famous thing about her was her son, which is really interesting because she is the history of the 20th century.
Yeah, for sure.
In every field, for crying out loud.
I know. And I'm sure I can find a pair of my Vanderbilt jeans somewhere in my closet.
You're, as you were wont to do, jumping ahead to the middle of the second or the third act in her life. I didn't say poor little rich girl derisively. That is literally what she became known as in the press when she was young. She was a socialite turned designer, artist, author, and as you said, the mother of CNN's Anderson Cooper, and by the way, three other kids. Let's not make him be the only son that she had. I think she had four. But as a designer, she was well known, as you say, for her signature stylish jeans that were highly sought after in the 70s and 80s, and as I'll talk about in a minute, were incredibly influential in the fashion world as well. But even before that, she was a writer and a visual artist and a headline maker really since her birth, because she was a member of the famous Vanderbilt family, for crying out loud.
They're a big deal.
She was born in 1924, was the daughter of Reginald Claypool Vanderbilt, heir to the railroad fortune, and her mother was Gloria Morgan Vanderbilt. The family money dated back to young Gloria's great-great-grandfather, Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt, and the story of that man and his offspring and their marriages. We could do a whole podcast about that for the next several months without it being uninteresting to me, really. But Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt himself was born poor and built a great fortune as a magnate of a 19th century transportation empire. Think about that, right?
That is something. He was a boat owner?
Well, he was a commodore, and then, of course, the trains, getting in early on trains, rail. Seeing that rail lines would connect this country. Family money couldn't buy an easy childhood for poor little Gloria Vanderbilt, though. Her father died when she was just 18 months old, leaving her with a paltry $5 million trust fund and a young mother who loved to jet around the world in search of a good time.
Ew.
Concerned with the upbringing little Gloria was undergoing, her paternal aunt, Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney, sued for custody. A very public custody battle ensued, dubbed, you're going to love this, the Trial of the Century by reporters at the time. By the way, I think we were talking about this when Klaus von Bülow died, how often there's Trials of the Century, right? We celebrated is the wrong word, but we took note of recently the 25th anniversary of the Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman murders, right?
Right.
And did you see that O.J. Simpson marked the 25th anniversary event by joining Twitter?
Oh, I didn't realize that was to mark the – I didn't realize the joining of the Twitter was a celebration of the trial. I thought it was just coincidence.
And as he said on the video that launched his Twitter feed, he's got some payback to dish out. So, anyway, back to Gloria Vanderbilt. The trial of the century. Anyway, she developed her artistic talents in school. She tried a little bit of everything: acting, painting, visual art, writing. And she ended up doing them all professionally. She starred in a handful of stage and television productions.
I did not know that.
But she found that work did not agree with her. And so she largely stopped acting within a few years. Her first book, Love Poems, was published in 1955 and was very well reviewed at the time.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm surprised.
But it was... Love Poems. It was design that would become Vanderbilt's passion. She was a commercial designer, and that sprang from her love of creating art. She had a series of her paintings licensed by Hallmark Cards
in
the 1960s and 70s. And then she was soon designing her own commercial products, including textiles and dinnerware.
Wow.
And dinnerware. So a bit of a Renaissance person. In 1976, she began the venture that would make her a household name. So realize that she's already into her 50s. And again, how much do I love these stories? These people who become so iconic for something that they don't find until well into their life. So this idea that people need to find the thing when they're in high school or college or in their 20s or whatever is belied by history. You can find it when you find it, and especially if you've been endowed with millions of dollars.
Right.
That's my first bit of advice, kids. Get a $5 million endowment in a trust fund, and then take your time, because you'll be more interesting that way. Anyway.
That's good advice.
that was when she partnered with the Mirjani Corporation and launched a line of designer jeans in her name. Each pair featured her signature on the back pocket along with her swan logo. She was one of the first to offer a stylish alternative to Levi's, which dominated the denim landscape at the time. And her jeans were slimmer and tighter fitting than the traditional work pant, as they were called. And her jeans, Gloria Vanderbilt jeans, opened doors for other designers who would soon come to be associated with denim, including Calvin Klein, Jordache, Sassoon. They all got their inspiration from Gloria Vanderbilt.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I guess that was the beginning of designer labels, right? I mean, she was a designer jeans, and then the whole designer fill in the blank became a thing right off the 80s all through the 90s, right?
So I could go on and on about her. We don't have time. I do want to mention something that I didn't realize until reading about her in the wake of her death, but married four times, including to Sidney Lumet. Did you know that?
I did not know that. That's interesting.
There you go. So Gloria Vanderbilt. 94, 95 years of age as well. Yeah. So that's two people well into their 90s that we've remembered. Finally, a remembrance of a very popular singing star of the 1960s, Jim Pike. Now, that name you probably don't remember, Jim Pike.
It's not jumping out.
Because he was a co-founder and lead singer of a music group known worldwide as The Letterman.
Oh,
formed in 1961, a group of college friends, including Bob Engeman and Tony Butala. The Letterman had terrific harmonies that were a success right away, including a Grammy-nominated song that charted right at the beginning of their career called The Way You Look Tonight that that came out that year they were formed, 1961. So the first year that they form in college, they have a Grammy-nominated song. They were most popular throughout the 60s. They hit the Billboard charts 20 times with such songs as When I Fall in Love and Theme from a Summer Place. One of the first albums I listened to as a little boy was my parents' The Letterman Greatest Hits there in the 1970s. So anyway, his brother Gary ends up joining the group in 1967. This is kind of interesting. So his brother joins the group in 1967, replacing his old college buddy Bob Engeman. But Jim Pike, the lead singer, his voice wore out from the constant touring, and he left the group in 1973. But he regained his voice after resting it, but instead of rejoining the group, which was still continuing to tour without him, he ended up just starting a new vocal group with Bob Engeman, the original member who also had left.
Of course, because you miss your friends, right?
Yeah. So Jim Pike, and the reason that I wanted to mention him this week is, speaking of the Letterman, David Letterman has returned to Netflix with season two of My Next Guest Needs No Introduction.
Right.
You sound thrilled by that. You sound...
Well, am I thrilled by it? I was hoping I'd enjoy that show more than I'm not enjoying it. Is that terrible? I changed?
Have you watched season two?
I started. I watched the bit with Kanye.
How interested are you going to be with Kanye? I mean, that's really
maybe the issue.
I mean, it is a 1 hour conversation with a guest, and. Yeah.
If you don't like that or his work or anything like that, yeah, that's a tough slog. Maybe that's the problem.
If you don't find the person interesting, I don't think I think even more than in season one, Dave is really bringing it. And anyway, episode two is with Ellen DeGeneres is spectacular television.
Okay. Okay, I'll give it a shot.
I mean, he gets her to talk about things she's never spoken of, like the details of the sexual assaults she endured at the hands of her stepfather. And but it's spectacular, and it's spectacular comedy. And they tour the Warner Brothers lot with each other. That alone is worth the price of admission. But I wanted to single in on one little bit of it, which is such a treat, and it really got me thinking. And it's a moment where Ellen and David Letterman, just while walking the Warner Brothers lot, where Ellen has not only her production offices, but a soundstage named for herself, where they just drop in on Clint Eastwood. Unannounced.
Unannounced.
And it's very funny. So I won't get into the visit. But one of the things that I realized watching Clint in that and realizing, yeah, this is true. Whenever those rare times I've seen Clint Eastwood as Clint Eastwood, even when he's getting angrily talking to an empty chair at a Republican National Convention, Clint Eastwood as Clint Eastwood in real life is such a light. He has such a lightness about him.
Oh, yeah.
Which is fascinating because his screen persona belies that. His screen persona of 60 years belies what a lightness of being he is.
Well, I guess it's, yeah, well, because he turns that on, right? It's when you embrace your shadow that you get rid of it. So he's been a lifetime of bad guys and shoot 'em ups and Dirty Harrys. And then, of course,
anti-heroes, anti-heroes.
Yeah.
And he understands, you know, no star, I mean, has ever understood their own iconic appeal more than Clint Eastwood has. I mean, this is why. This is why he's still Clint Eastwood in his 90s, for crying out loud. But I was thinking about how it is, you know, I was scratching my head going, have I ever seen this lightness in a Clint Eastwood performance? And then lo and behold, as I am wont to do sometimes, especially when I don't feel well, Clint Eastwood movies for some reason are a big go-to to me when I don't feel well. And so this week, a couple of the ones that I caught, one, a reviewing of Where Eagles Dare.
Oh, yes. The great war movie, On Top of the Gondola.
Which is one of the only movies, right, where Clint Eastwood appears on screen with a star who was at least as big as a star as he was.
Right.
And really was a bigger star. This is after the Spaghetti Western trilogy, and it was deemed it would be really smart for him to appear in a big Hollywood movie with a major established star to open the door to new audiences appreciating Clint. And he and Richard Burton got on like gangbusters. So it's a, you know, it's a suspenseful spy story based on a real event, I guess, a real escapade that took place in World War II, and directed by Brian Hutton, who would again collaborate with Clint just a year or so later on one of your favorite war films, and I think very much a superior to Where Eagles Dare, and that's Kelly's Heroes.
Yes, yes, for sure, where they go rob a bank.
But so I watched that, and it's, you know, it doesn't offer Clint much of a chance to stretch. I mean, he plays an assassin in it, but it's a crowd pleaser. There's no question about that, Where Eagles Dare. But the other one was one of the big Eastwood hits, a handful of Eastwood hits through the decades, and he has so many of them, but that I had not seen, one of only a few that I had not seen before. And that is a one that he also directed called The Bridges of Madison County.
Oh, you know, I remember that giving that a miss, too. It seemed a slow, romantic roll in the hay with Meryl Streep and Clint Eastwood playing a life photographer who's taking pictures of covered bridges. Now, for some reason, that pitch doesn't really jump off the page to me.
Now, I don't know if I would have enjoyed it when it came out. I was 26, 27, 27 probably when it came out.
So it wasn't in your market demographic, right, as they say.
23 years later, the story of middle-aged love maybe holds more appeal to me. But so too do films that take a more measured approach, you know, take their time, that breathe. Yeah. Although I always appreciated old cinema, right? I always had a love of history of cinema, so I didn't have an affinity for any particular kind of pacing or not. So I don't know. I really don't know what my feelings would have been then. I do know that I find it incredibly refreshing now, especially the very charming first hour, because of how Clint, as a director, lets this unfold, in part. I was fascinated to read that, of course, they filmed it very much on location near where the book was set. And most of the film's action is set in the 1960s. But what I love is that Clint uses his authority, the power that he can muster as a filmmaker, because he's Clint Eastwood, and he's only a couple years coming off, by the way, winning for Best Picture and Best Director for Unforgiven. So he could really, you know, demand whatever he wanted from a production standpoint. And they shoot this film in chronological order, not in the order of the script, but in the chronological order of how events occur through the eyes of the main character, Francesca. And for those people who don't know, this is rarely done, right? Because logistically, it's difficult. It means you have to keep going to locations, leaving those locations, going to other locations, coming back to previous locations. It's time-consuming. It's costly. There's risk involved, because what happens if in the interim a location gets damaged?
Burnt down. I know. Those bridges, they're wood, for crying out loud. They could go.
But his reasoning behind it was, this is a story about 4 days where two people who meet are getting to know each other. Uh-huh. And that was his thing. It was about two people getting to know each other. And he said, so the actors need to be getting to know each other at the same time.
Interesting.
And so they shot it in sequence there, in chronological order. And it really benefits the performances, and it really, you can tell, it's really wonderful, like I say, for the first hour. Then it falls into all the tropes of, I'm sure, that were in the novel itself. In fact, it made me say, someday I want to have on a poster for a movie that I make based on the best-selling Summer Beach Read.
That does cover your ass on that one,
because that's the kind of book it feels like. But at least for that first hour, getting to see how this technique really lends itself to very authentic and moving and charming performances, and then to find out that Clint Eastwood, again being Clint Eastwood, they film it in 42 days. 42 days is a nice amount of time to make a movie, but that meant they finished 10 days early.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because they get it in one take?
Well, I don't know, you know, but I mean, I love that. Don't you love that Clint is like, no, we don't need to squeeze every last dollar that they've given us. No, right? We're done. We got it. Let's go home.
Fantastic.
Anyway, what I want to say, though, is that if you are a Clint Eastwood fan, as I am, what is so fun and refreshing about the film is his performance. She got nominated for every award there was for it.
Right.
But it's a really fine performance. And I got to tell you, first of all, I think I've got a working thesis that Meryl Streep might be at her best when she is opposite not a quote-unquote great actor, but when she is opposite a great star. That really pushes her game in a new direction. And think Robert Redford in Out of Africa, for example. So there's that. But his performance, he lets in all the natural light, which is so appropriate because he plays a photographer. But he lets in all the natural light that Clint Eastwood, the man, carries with him in the real world, and he lets it in the R-E-E-L world. Did I just throw in three E's to real, maybe?
You did.
So I feel like for that first hour as they're getting to know each other, damn if we are not seeing the character he plays that's closest to the authentic Clint Eastwood. And he's so good in it. He's so good, Dean.
Well, I'm shocked because I know there was Oscar, you know, Meryl Streep wins a bunch and she's nominated all the time. So it's hard to keep track of how good she is. But to hear Clint Eastwood being good, great in this, again, maybe it's the age that we're in that we'll enjoy a slower paced movie. Is that the case? Or is it...
I think there is a timelessness to how he makes movies, and when he finds the right material, that works very, very well. When he makes, whether it be a foreign language war film, like Letters from Iwo Jima, or a 1960s period romance, Bridges of Madison County, an elegiac western like Unforgiven. That timeless classical storytelling fits very, very well. And when we say leisurely, we should also point out, though, that this is someone who also doesn't overstay his welcome. He's not making films of epic length.
It's that
the scenes are allowed to breathe. The actors are allowed to explore character. It's really classical filmmaking, but he also understands the importance of economy. Economy of scale, economy of length. That was always the problem that he had with the Sergio Leone westerns. He loved Sergio's films and thought, can you imagine how much greater they would have been at an hour shorter running time? That was his attitude, you know. So it is fascinating to me. The other old film that I saw that I revisited, this is the 30th anniversary of several great films. 1989, in retrospect, had a handful of great, great films. A few weeks ago, I watched, maybe a little bit longer, but I watched Do the Right Thing again. And that was 89. I saw The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover had a limited theatrical here locally recently, and that was a big influence on me, including giving me an idea that we follow in terms of a color scheme in The Motif. Lady Killers. Yeah. But I watched on the big screen this weekend the 30th anniversary of John Woo's The Killer.
Oh, right. This is the epic shoot 'em up in slow motion with doves flying around. Things that are now parodied all the time were visually striking when John Woo first did them.
Yeah, it was it's balletic action. Remember, that was the word. Ballet suddenly started to be a word used in association with gun violence on cinema. But what's interesting, you use the word epic, and that's what people think of, is these epic action sequences. And yet, like so many of the great epics, they are great because of the intimacy. And this is, as he said when he appeared in person to show the film, it was his desire to make a European crime movie. He wanted to make a French crime movie in the Chinese language with Hong Kong actors, and that's what he did. So it's every bit Melville's Le Samurai. It's a new wave film. It's also, you know, it's almost those matched with Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch. And yet, yes, it creates a whole new style and genre of action. But what really surprised me was how much it's the emotion and the intimacy with the characters that made that movie work and still make that movie work.
That's fascinating because that's you know, when I think back on it, and again, I haven't seen it in 20 years, but it's not what sticks in my mind. But it has to be there, because otherwise, like the copies we've seen, when you just have epic slow motion gun violence without any grounding in character or emotional reality, it's all forgettable. So
what, you've got to care, as he said.
Yeah.
That was it. He said, you got to care about these characters. And that's
right.
What it's not that contemporary action, you know, the makers of contemporary franchises and action movies, that they don't understand that. It's that they don't understand why we'll care about a character. It's not about giving character notes that make us care, right? It's not that single-spaced description in the script that can make an audience care. It's got to actually be the revelation of character as discovered and explored by an actor. And, oh, man, Chow Yun-fat. Seeing him as a young man again and being reminded, oh, yeah, of course, this guy would be... he leaps off the screen as a movie star. Everyone who saw this wanted to be him. And no matter what country you were in. And the other thing that struck me that was really surprising was as scenes would unfold, I would go, oh, yes, I remember now. I remember this. I remember this. Because going in, I was saying, how much of this do I really remember? But as it unfolded, oh, yes, I do remember all this. But as you alluded to, there are some set pieces that, at least in my memory, tended to overshadow much of what came before in the movie.
Right.
But those elaborate set pieces, like the giant shootout at the French-looking villa, the giant shootout in the church with the doves flying, those are fine, and I watch them, but it's the moments of tension and suspense earlier in the film that build upon each other that you go, man, these are still really good today.
Wow.
The first hit when he goes into the nightclub, the iconic image of him, you know, he's run out of bullets, but he notices a handgun on a card table and he quickly kicks the card table up. The gun flies in the air. He grabs it and shoots it in one motion. Iconic. It would still be great today. It still shows through action the way this person looks at things, the way this person keeps a calm head in the midst of chaos. It's revelatory of character. The assassination from a boat, from a speedboat, that has been so often copied and yet never matched. The moment on a beach where the killer is struck by a wave of a cute little girl playing on the beach, and he takes a moment to take her in and enjoy her playing, and then suddenly notices her get distracted by something, and knowing that he has shielded himself because that's how he walks anywhere, even out in the open, he always uses natural cover because you never know who's gunning for you. And then slowly takes off his sunglasses to wipe them clean and uses them as a mirror to check a reflection at, and find out what that little girl might have been distracted by. It's they're breathtaking scenes. And and those are the scenes that hold up even better because, again, when people imitated it, when it changed everything, they went to the big stuff and not to the stuff that built, that made that big stuff work, because by that point, we already cared about the character.
Right. Interesting. Now I'm going to watch this again. I'm taking David Letterman and Ellen DeGeneres off my list and putting Killers on my list.
The Killer.
Yes,
don't do Killers. You'll get a different film altogether. So it's John Woo's The Killer. And this segues into a conversation I mentioned last week I wanted to have. And this is about how, you know, we've got franchise fatigue. We've got so many big screen franchises that are just, I mean, the box office has been imploding ever since Avengers Endgame, which is, it's been re-released with new footage so that it can pass Avatar as the all-time box office champ. So at the same time, you've got a brand new box office champ making $900 million domestically. You've got Godzilla. You've got an X-Men movie, Dark Phoenix. You've got The Secret Life of Pets 2. You've got Men in Black International. You've got Shaft. And they're all losing money. All of them are losing money hand over fist. And people write it off to franchise fatigue or sequelitis, and those things might be true. There's also the very real possibility that if you want to get people to come to the theater these days, the movie has to be good.
There's that. And I think now our tastes are so fragmented. I'm wondering now, you know, what is good? Because your definition of it and our definition might be different than, say, those who've been playing video games or Minecraft or online streaming or, you know, whatever their appetite they grew up with watching has altered one's ability to have a common consensus of what even a good movie is.
Yes, and that is chaos, and nobody wants that. So that's why, Dean, significantly, we live in a time of aggregators. We get our news through aggregation, right? Clickbait.
Right.
But we also get our movie reviews through aggregators, through Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic.
Right.
So what does it mean, Dean? Well, it is all about consensus. And I think that's because, I mean, think about this. When we used to have common frames of cultural reference, movies and television shows, we read individual critics. We weren't reading consensus lists. We didn't have consensus websites. We didn't have magazines that published critic consensus. We read individual critics that we followed, and yet we were reading individual thoughts about films and television shows watched by mass populations. Now we are gravitating towards consensus thought directed at niche movie and television programming.
Fascinating.
And I think that's why. It's the comfort that offsets it. We want to know what the consensus thinks. So that's it. You need to have a certain number. Or I think because it's not that the film will hold no appeal. It's you know, because the people are scratching their heads. I don't understand it. Why wouldn't at least X-Men fans go to see the new X-Men movie? Why wouldn't they? Why are they staying away in droves? Why are they paying to not have to see it? And I think it's because, even for the fans, well, you know, it will be out on video soon enough. It'll be out on demand soon enough. I don't need to go to the movies to see it. And in the meantime, if I want that fix, I have immediate access to all the good X-Men movies that have come out. There are so many of them. I could spend weeks watching all of them if I wanted to. And so there is no need there. There is no hunger. There is no need. And then when the consensus says this one's not really very good, you'd be better off watching one of the good ones. Okay, we'll do that. We'll watch one of the good ones.
Yeah, do that.
Then,
fascinating.
Then you flip the page and you get to Toy Story 4. This movie comes out, and don't kid yourself, it's a hit. It makes $118 million in its opening weekend. It gets as good a reviews as a fourthquel possibly can.
Right.
I think it's like 98% positive or something like that on Rotten Tomatoes. So the reviews are outstanding, and $118 million is a huge opening. The worrying sign, though, is that the prognosticators, the box office prognosticators, who are usually pretty damn good at this game, thought, and these are people hired by the studios to predict what it'll make, right? Had this tabbed as $140 million opening last week. So percentage-wise, that's a big drop-off.
Right.
And
so miss? What did they miss? What? Who didn't go?
Well, I think there's, I think it probably, what I've read, and this kind of resonated with me, was there's Toy Story fans. There's no question about this. There's people who love Toy Story in a way that I never have loved these movies.
Right.
I like them. I don't love them. I don't need them. But there's people who really, really deep, profound affection for these movies. And they got the perfect concluding chapter with Toy Story 3. Nobody needed a Toy Story 4. The story was told. And now you're adding a fourth. Why? I'm not saying that it's necessarily a craven money cash grab or because of the product locomotive of Disney. Of course, those things are all true. But let's say that the storytellers had a real reason they wanted to make this, something they wanted to express. Good for them, right? But you kind of have to prove that to your audience because most of them were really satisfied with how that story concluded. And that itself is such a rarity. To be satisfied with how character stories conclude, that there's resistance, there's hesitancy.
To add a second, I know, because if you have a perfect 3-act story, and then you go, oh, by the way, and then another thing happened, you're like, oh, really? It's not a disappointment. You're upset at the storyteller for, not deking you out, but actually messing with their own quality.
So I was wondering what lessons can we learn? And I think the first one is, and this is exciting news, when it comes to franchises, and we'll talk about smaller movies and alternative, you know, programming and comedies and all this and how they're doing at the box office next week. But just looking at franchises, one, they need to be good, right? Two, it's about building franchises. Right, all the emphasis is so often on these sequels and what franchises can we make new movies to and everything. But at some point, you got to make new franchises.
Yeah,
and by the way, that's being done. We have a franchise that you and I have talked about, the John Wick franchise.
Well, there you go. Yeah, that's a surprise, isn't it?
Well, you know, the first movie which we loved. Made $40 million at the domestic box office. People thought, well, this is going to be ridiculous. This is, I mean, how Keanu Reeves in an action film had become a modestly budgeted idea, I don't know in the years, but it had. It seemed like, you know, Keanu Reeves was in his late Charles Bronson period now. Who wants to see this? So they make the first John Wick movie, $40 million domestic. It's a bit of a sleeper hit. They go, yeah, let's double down. Let's give a little bit of a bigger budget, make a sequel. Yeah. That makes $80 to $90 million. It doubles the box office of the first one. And they put the more money on screen to expand the world of the character.
Right.
The third one doing even better still than the second one. Right. And again, expanding the world that the character walks through. I'm wondering, and it's an interesting time to talk about the John Wick films because, you know, Marvel is the other example that I think that that franchises can learn from, that studios can learn from. And yet, ironically, Marvel's holy grail is to get Keanu Reeves to star in one of their movies. And he always turns them down.
Oh, does he?
Yeah. He doesn't seem to have any interest in doing a superhero. And good for him, really. You know?
Well, true.
Partly because at this point, we have two appealing franchises. We've got Keanu Reeves and we've got Marvel. You put them together, we've got one fewer appealing franchise.
Well, that's very true. And I can't even think of a Marvel superhero that he would portray. That would be a fit.
Let's not forget, he did play John Constantine, Hellblazer, once several years ago. And you like to think he learned his lesson. But anyway, you know what Marvel does very well, apropos of The Killer, is, and it's something that John Wick did very well from the very beginning. They work tirelessly to make sure that you care about the characters.
Right? Yes. Well, because they're guardians. I mean, Marvel has to, they're the guardians of these characters that have been there a lot, been their bread and butter since comic books were invented. I mean, so of course they're not going to fuck with that.
Well, you say of course, but how good are the DC origin stories? They have not been. You say of course, but it's not easy. And in fact, looking at Marvel, it almost seems like, you know, a product from the corporate standpoint, a product of luck. Iron Man is the one that really launches the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Surprisingly, they've attempted the Hulk, which was a much bigger star character in their pantheon, and those nobody ever cared about on the big screen. But Iron Man, that first Iron Man, people really cared. And it was the magic, in no small way, the alchemy of actor and character. There was something in Tony Stark that matched Robert Downey Jr.'s desire to reinvent himself and to prove himself, given what he had gone through, that that informed each other, right? Robert Downey Jr. brought out the best in Tony Stark, and dare I say, Tony Stark brought out the best in Robert Downey Jr., and we cared. You had an actor who intrinsically our society had always cared about, even when he was, you know, even when he was on drugs and showing up in little kids, strange little kids' bedrooms, right?
Right. People, which he thought it was his own.
Yeah. But people weren't shooting first and asking questions later. They were going, oh, poor Robert Downey Jr. people cared. And but then also think about the massive success of Black Panther. That was, I think that's the third biggest hit of all time domestically. And that's an origin story. And it surprised everybody, including, I think, Marvel. And people cared about that movie. And they cared about it, by the way, not just because of character, but because of also worldview. That movie resonated in contemporary life about not only racial politics, but about how an entire group of people get to see themselves depicted on screen for the first time. Their cultural struggles depicted in noble, heroic fashion. And that was such a need, such a hunger, which ties it back to the original Iron Man. There was a need and a hunger for a superhero, for an action figure who would literally embody the idea that a wounded heart can be your strength.
Right.
We needed that when Iron Man came out.
It's
and
true.
We needed Black Panther when that came out. Don't give people the movie they want. Give them the movie they need.
Right. So this requires one to be sensitive to the zeitgeist and figure out what we need at the moment. What bomb do we as a society need?
And and understand the stories again are about character and who are the best people to explore the world that these characters are going to be exploring. Who are the best people to embody these characters that will be exploring that world? The John Wick movies are a good template for this, right? Mm-hmm. We care from the beginning. We have this idea of a character who's going to speak almost not at all. In fact, we are going to tip our hats overtly to the silent films that are our inspirations, to the Buster Keaton films that are our inspirations. Who is an actor that people will care about even if he remains silent throughout almost the entire movie? Oh, well, you know who? It's someone who, like Clint Eastwood before him, audiences have proven to care about And maybe care about more when they don't speak, because Keanu Reeves was always kind of made fun of a little bit in his line delivery at times, right?
Right.
And
his English accent in Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula.
And it was, I remember Charlie Sheen once scratched his head on some interview going, are you kidding me? Why Keanu Reeves? Why does Keanu Reeves get to work with every great director? What are they seeing that we're not seeing? Right? Because many people would get caught up in the trappings of Keanu Reeves as a bad actor. And, you know, the same was said about Clint Eastwood when he was becoming a movie star. But there's something iconic in them that we really care about. And it comes through in these men often when they're being silent.
Right. They're just resonating. Resonating charm? What's that term? Oozing? Do they ooze?
And the thing that with John Wick, again, is a model that I would follow, were I somebody in the game of building franchises. Uh-huh. And it's a model that was born out more than 50 years ago, going on 60 years now, by the James Bond movies, which is want to launch a franchise, launch it modestly. Start small. The James Bond film started as drive-in movies. The first James Bond film, Dr. No, modestly budgeted, did not even get released into cinemas in the U.S. It was released on the drive-in circuit. It was a modest hit. And then they built on that with a slightly bigger film, From Russia with Love. And then went all in, pushed their chips into the middle with a big budget spectacle of Goldfinger. But doesn't that sound a little bit like John Wick? We started small. We made it a little bit bigger. And now we went all in with part three.
I think the Kingsman was supposed to be that, right? That Kingsman was going to be, you know, it's an origin story of passing the baton on in the secret organization. And then Kingsman 2 was supposed to be that plus more. But it seemed like they were being big off the top and just knowing that they already had a product locomotive that was going to go. So there was arrogance there.
Well, I think it's a trap that a lot of people fall into because it's an origin story and they put all the money into it to make it big. So we show people, this is the origin, but look at the spectacle that you're going to get time and time again from this franchise. Right. Sounds great. And it works, but it's fool's gold. It works on movies from Batman Begins to J.J. Abrams' Star Trek to Daniel Craig's Casino Royale and on and on and on. But as we've talked about a lot during the 12 years of this show, the second movie is the one that proves whether or not you knew what you were doing, not the first one.
That's so true.
Quantum of Solace, it feels a letdown after Casino Royale. Star Trek Into Darkness, a letdown after the first Star Trek movie. Now
Matrix 2.
Matrix 2. Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight obviously then expands upon it. But I think, so it's fool's gold to throw all in the big spectacle the first time. Allow the idea that big things start from humble beginnings.
Right.
And maybe not an origin story. That's the easiest place to go. And it makes a certain amount of sense, but we were always taught this in storytelling classes, not just in film, but in literature classes all the way through grade school, which is a story should begin in media res. It begins in the middle, not at the start. You always have the origin to explore, but start in the middle of the story. John Wick begins with the guy having already left his life as an assassin. The
right.
story is, for all intents and purposes, over. And not only is that story over, but the story of what got him out of that story, i.e. falling in love and getting married, that story is over because she's died of cancer.
Right.
So this movie opens on a widower grieving. That's the opening. It's not
yes.
an origin story at all.
Exactly.
It's about how does a man not get sucked back into his previous life. James Bond, Dr. No. It's definitely in media ray. It's not an origin of James Bond.
He's already the spy.
Yeah, he's already the spy. And
well, I think Kingsman should have done that too, right? It should have just been Colin Firth on a mission. And then at the very end, going, I'm too old for this shit. We got to find somebody new. And then the Kingsman, as we know, would have been the second one. And then you would have been on the story. You would have been on the build.
Well, there's an idea if you wanted to make a series or a franchise out of it, right? Maybe that is part of even the first movie, this idea of, you know, I need to go and recruit a replacement. We're only as good. And what an interesting theme to explore, because it's something that in modern corporate life, everybody's forgotten, where everybody seems to think my value is shown by how I cannot be replaced. But for every previous generation, they knew that, no, you're only as good as how easy it is to replace you. You've done a great job if, should something happen to you, you have already trained a replacement so that the rest of us do not suffer because
right.
of what happened to you. That's a sign of someone really doing their job. So what if this guy does realize, not just I'm too old for this shit or I'm tired of it, but what about, no, it's part of my duty to make sure that there is someone to replace me at the table. And
right.
I'm going to find a suitable replacement. And the movie doesn't have to be about that. That's something that he's got going on while he's doing his job. It's part of the job. And then you've opened yourself up to a lot of delightful false attempts at that, false starts. But you also get to really explore, okay, what actors are we bringing in? What young actors really enjoy a delightful chemistry with our lead, with the other characters? And when we
right.
found them, we go, okay, we know as storytellers, yeah, this is the guy.
Yeah. Wow. So there you go. You've already put a model out for the next product locomotive and just wait for someone to get to their typewriter and start banging that script out.
Well, good, because we've gone 17 minutes overtime, so I'm glad uh-huh. that we've helped people in some way. All right,
yeah.
We'll be back to talk about more movies, more box office, more celebrity deaths, and to talk about what we were talking about 12 years ago that very week, when
yeah,
we
thanks.
Join you next week on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. For now, like I said, we're continuing to rebuild the website, chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. And let's just give people the email address, Dean, so they can write us if there's something they want us to talk about.
Right. You can write us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. It's all one big word. And we answer all those emails.
Or we don't. Or we answer
don't.
The ones that are interesting to
okay.
us where we have something to say.
Yes, or the ones you could actually read with your eyes.
Oh, that's true. That's true. If you could only read what I have read with your eyes.
So please put it in a bigger font if you're writing in the next 2 days.
All right. Until next week, I'm your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.